happy to be here. I've never been to this poetry gathering before, but I'm really impressed, and I want to thank Paul for inviting me down. It's a real honour to be here. I'm going to read, first of all, from The Painter's House, a few poems, and maybe a few more recent ones then as well. Okay, so I just put on the reading glasses. A new pair of eyes might be nice. I'll start actually with the first poem in this collection, The Painter's House, because there is actually a kind of chronology to it. And the first poem is called Timepiece, and it's a poem dedicated to the memory of my great-grandfather, Joseph Wengler, from Germany. So he's a man I never knew. My parents were both, we came to Ireland when I was like 5 from England, so he was a man none of us were really aware of. But I'm fascinated by the memory of him. Timepiece. In the wardrobe of my belonging is a bearskin coat. I've never worn it. I must remember to take it out, have it altered to fit, take a walk with the bear on my back. I'd like to find him inside it, my great-grandfather. The clock wound back so I could see him as he was, his nimble fingers placing the pins, his musical ear timing the cogs, his eye like a moon in the ocular. I'd like to walk across Europe to Feldberg and climb to the top, sit with him looking out on a snowy vista. We'd talk about time and the clocks he made, and why he left his house by the lake, why he never went back, why his bearskin coat hangs in my house, a ghost of truth no one speaks about. Is his the mark on my poet face, why I'm always a stranger from another place? And this next poem is called Abeyance, and it's one of a selection of poems, or a collection of poems, written on the life of Gwen John, the Welsh artist. And I studied her for quite a while and spent some time in Paris. She was, of course, Rodin's lover. She became one of the most influential painters of her generation. She was the sister to Augustus John. Abeyance. Watch her, though the day moves through her and her through it, her true state is suspended. Aspirant. Some days she sits in a state of suspension for a long time. This is different to waiting. Waiting is the possibility of something. The nature of abeyance is that nothing resolves. She understands this. Some days she comes fully prepared and nothing happens. Only ends resolve. Only ends are completely without fear. And this is a poem called Christina's World. Wythe painted a picture, and it'll be very familiar to a lot of people, of a woman on a kind of raised landscape going up towards a house called Christina's World. And I was very influenced by Andrew Wythe's thinking and seeing when I was an art student way back. And several years ago I did a road trip in America, and it brought that back to me, and it brought me back to that time. Of being youthful and away off in America. So here it is, Christina's World. Buy a day, get the summer free, was something I saw from a speeding car and jotted down. We were driving northeast from LA, the freeway spinning out and flat, everything getting whiter. It's all purchase and count, even days, even seasons. I could feel it, the summer unrolling in the heat, in the early light. Cars shimmery like jewels, a mirage obscuring vision. And the landscape in the distance, the width of it, fields stretching so far, edges becoming suddenly luminous, dangerous. Like that painting by Andrew Weiss, Christina's World, the gold grass, the house a dark mouth yawning on a high horizon. I was 20. I thought Weiss was God. I wanted to touch his eyes, see through them. I was thinking summer, its lightness, its purity. One long day after another, mother's voice calling us in. Fleeting sounds, birdsong, buzzing, a lawnmower, like loneliness or longing. Raspberries swollen and warm, red teeth, a shower of roses tipping the garden wall. Smells of fresh mint and rosemary. Windows thrown open, Joni Mitchell playing it out. The coyote, a dead part that woke and shook. An old witch stick quivering its magic. If I could raise the price of a day, I'd be home and dry. I could cut my costs in other ways, sell my future. Hell, I'm 56. What comes after this? One free summer for a day. It's which to choose, how much to pay. And this poem is called Lonesome Big City Dweller. And it's a poem I wrote for one of my sons, David. And he had been away in London several years working, as had the other son. And they were ringing on Skype, and that was the new form of communication. And this is really, you know, it's a poem for people who leave home, and it's for the people who are also left behind. But it kind of tries to get into other things too. He just popped onto my screen, DNA. Transposition of the family line, so like beauty, I'm stunned. It's true, I say to myself, we love them way beyond ourselves. They make us the aspiration we once had. I remember the first surrealist book I bought and the photo montage, Lonesome Big City Dweller. Bears' large eyes staring out from open palms. And I see him, our adult son, his face inside the security enclosure, fixed between two spheres, a nowhere that doesn't hold him fast, an image as fleeting as a sunbeam. I imagine his shoulders sprout plumage. I can feel the thrum of tiny wing beats like a fan. We drift in and out of conversation, and I'm thinking how we slip through shapes, how we replicate a semblance, a word, a perspective, like bears' ghostly fingers, fingerprinting chimeras on a building, or a paleontologist's find, a wing bone caught in siltstone, our fibrous strand stretching into the future, a spot so insignificant it seems where I was is where I am. A species lost in thought, a genus of brooding dream. Not the smooth progression, stardust to his hand waving across a vast tremulous expanse, but a double helix set to music we'll never understand. Thank you. next poem is called Forgiveness. And it's after reading Alan Peterson's On the Nature of Forgiveness. Alan Peterson came, he's an American poet, to Limerick once, and we became friends. And he's an artist also, as well as being a poet. And at the front of his book of poems, there was what I describe in this, a chair floating. And so this is after reading Alan Peterson's On the Nature of Forgiveness. I took your floating chair and its shadow and sat in the half light reading The Nature of Forgiveness. Something I know about in my own way, if it's possible, after small deaths and genocides, Syria, February 2012, women and children, hands tied behind their backs. Early morning birds are up, soffit to treetop, home to the determined, the heartbeat at the centre. And the apple blossoms pimp mutely, the clematis, its minute, minute by minute, opening out to light, as if it had one word to repeat in its short life, forgiveness. Things crop up or come back in spite of beauty. Dregs of old arguments, disappointments. No matter how we clear it out, the head house of dust and droppings, forgiveness for some is a country too far away. If we get there, it's the letting down of trouble. It's feeling the earth heal, one dark spot amended. And this book is called, or sorry, this poem is called Last Journey. Last Journey. Those words came to me like someone slipping in through the back door of a cinema just as the film begins. There he is, standing in the dark, unseen. The air is suddenly heavy. A smell of cut wood, familiar as a workshed full of fodder. And I'm watching people I've loved flit across the screen. I realise I still love them. I carry them around. They weigh in me, but they are blameless as shadows. Then an interlude, a short movie about me. I'm holding a swan in my arms. It is large and cumbersome, oily as a fish. I watch myself struggle with my awkwardness. I'm waiting for the audience to laugh. Someone coughs at the back of the cinema. It sounds like Shame suddenly shook himself and left. I'm looking into the swan's eyes. I'm surprised by their depth, and its beak is gnarled, the colour of silt and spilt egg. Then it tips my lips with its beak. A kiss, a tiny discharge bubbles between us. A woman leans over, whispers in my ear. She insists I leave immediately and go to the clinic for rare and tropical diseases. I'm infected, she says. I look up. The swan has gone, and I'm alone in a waiting room, listening to trains passing into darkness, to daylight, to darkness. And I'll read just one more from this book, and it's a book really about the death of Gwen John, because when she died, which was quite a young age, I think 63, she simply got on a train in Paris and got off in Dieppe and collapsed in Dieppe. And that's where she died. Subsequent to being Rodin's lover for many years, she became, as I said, devoted to her art. After his death, she became equally devoted to Catholicism, and if you like, in some kind of weird way, that god replaced the intense love of Rodin. But she devoted herself in a kind of very almost religious way to her painting. But this is the how I imagine her last train journey. It's called The Last of the Weather. And there's a little quotation from Gwen John, a seer of strange beauties, a teller of harmonies. The painter boarded the train for Dieppe. It was September. The air was cool. An image from a dream stayed with her of a coastal town, a beach to wander. Chloe had written earlier of wind on the sea, how it rippled the surface, and light caught inside made it translucent, sinuous, silver. The night before, sitting at a brasserie in Paris, she heard the news. France and Germany were at war. She felt lonely, confused. In the same letter, I'm sending an almond tree. Its blossom will cheer you. She sat by a window and slept awkwardly. The tilt of the train, its monotony, lulled her. Sounds floated, waves, gulls, westerlies. Thin souls conjured from cloud drifted landward. The world changed. Filtered through the particular, it diffused, became tones, shades, volume, space. She wrote in her notebook, stages of decay, a color memory, hint of blue, heart's dried pigment, white dust sifting, formless and indistinct. Time of day and seasons, her mother sitting on a beach, wind sweeping up sand, the child painter watching from a cliff, her sketchbook tied with a strap, a pocket of pencil, her hat blown back, her eyes held by the glare, intent on the mystery. The painter painted the last of the weather and made her way to the sea. She stood on the shoreline. Birds flew in the clouds. Dark spots moved on the water. Waves broke round her feet. Thunder sounded. It's over Broad Haven, she thought. Bride's Bay in darkness. Rocks daubed with rain. A smell of iodine and salt corrosion. She glimpsed the light, its strangeness and wonder. She felt changes of colour, subtleties of tone, each of the other, everything seeping together, making the world seamless, complete. A small boat drifted in, a toy she'd hand-painted and set on the sea a long time ago. A craft someone might find and climb into. So I'll just finish with a few of these poems. They're new ones, and they're called diary entries. Now, they're diary entries, but they are actually prose poems, and there is a narrative to them. When I say diary entries, it seems to me that when one is writing in a diary, which I've never done, it has to be said, that you are free, you know, you feel totally free and confident, so you can imagine whatever you like. And so these diary entries I'm going to read to you tonight, there's three of them, are actually, they're actually clear because I actually know what I'm trying to say in these. My friend Maeve Kelly, the writer, always says, try and write about, try and be clear about what you write. So this first one is called Compass. And I'd like to just say a little word about it because it refers to the Madras in the Plaza de Mayo in Buenos Aires. And these, of course, are the mothers of the disappeared. And my brother died 2 years ago. So that kind of comes into it as well. But the narrative tells itself. But that is the most important thing. And to this day, they still circle the square in Buenos Aires. This is an amazing thing. And I have great respect for them. So this is called diary entry, compass. Let it all go is my intuition. Some situations require rational thinking. He was here, now he's gone. My sister rang from far away. What she tried to say sounded urgent. She was traveling alone in Buenos Aires the night she phoned. Stars filled the sky. Exquisite night bowed above me. Her voice rose and fell. Words became tiny tremors. Her sound was interrupted by signals, codes, letters, numbers. Something was using our distance to transmit indescribable longing. I heard the word brother, or was it other, or mother? I'd catch hisses, a pulse pounding, murmurs, silence. Then a howl like a wolf hurting, or a madras in the Plaza de Mayo. And I thought of our brother, how he disappeared one midsummer evening, and how we've been searching. A moment of closeness. I asked her, are you in the square with them? With the grandmothers whose white scarves billow like souls? Are you waiting for him to return? A swallow buried in cloud. Thank you. And this next one is called Diary Entry Tarot. And again, I have a friend who reads the tarot and I get great insights out of her reading of the tarot. And I'm kind of fascinated by it, really. Anyway, there's one card that I never really like getting, and it's Judgment. And the Judgment card, it's often, I have to say, man is the Judgment card. And so this comes up in this. A black and white photograph lay on the table. A heavy man posed as a monument, his bearded chin resting on a large fisted hand. He was upside down, the way monuments often appear in dreams or as major arcanas in a tarot reading. It always means bad news, or at least the reverse of free thinking. Monuments are mounds things, like handcuffs or cufflinks. Stone effigies raised high so their heads interrupt infinity. A tear in the photograph implied carelessness, as if he'd been buried alive, forgotten inside a shoebox of memorabilia. From his imposing head came the sweetest sound. I was reminded of something my mother said about an obese opera singer. There's a small bird in his throat. And there was, because when the singer died, a bird flew from his mouth, shedding feathers of soft blue light. He told me of an artist who made fine porcelain sculptures. His work is in museums, under bell jars. He's the purest artist of his generation. Another, he said, paints with menstrual blood. A contemporary Methuselah, she wanders about churning disquiet, causes riots, obfuscates a truth. This wasn't a judgment, he said, though now I knew who he was, a stone angel sent to summon the dead, the father of absolutes. I'll finish on this poem. It's called The Broken Woman, and it's about a little sculpture that Richard found in a skip and brought home. And she's only that high, but she's in the garden. And it's called The Broken Woman. It will be her second winter coming next. the broken woman I found in a skip and saved her. Saved her who fell or slept and forgot to wake. Small statuette, I fixed her broken legs. Her severed breasts I replaced with cups. I put a stick in the hollow of her wrist to hang a lamp. At night she has a purpose, my guide to hiddenness stands between the fig tree and the rose, no taller than my arm, at arm's length the span to touch her flame when it is lit. Along a rail of light, she breathes her livingness. Thank you very much.